May it please the court, members of the court, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm Ed Gill. I represent Scott O'Reilly, the plaintiff below, who is the appellant before this court. This case involves an issue regarding the trial court's granting a new trial on the basis of excluded expert opinion from a medical doctor. What that excluded medical opinion from that doctor was the possibility that an EMG, a diagnostic test, may reveal a possibility of one of two possible problems with the upper extremity of Mr. O'Reilly, which would possibly lead to surgery, depending on what was seen on the EMG, which would possibly diminish the permanent injury which Mr. O'Reilly suffered in the accident, which brought us before the trial court here.
Mr. O'Reilly, in the first trial, got a six-figure verdict, right?
Yes, sir.
And that was of return. There was a second trial, and the second verdict was $7,500 and change. Is that about right?
That's correct.
And it took a year between the first and the second decisions. How did that happen?
I don't have an explanation. The defense filed a timely motion for new trial. The plaintiff responded in appropriate fashion, and the trial court didn't schedule anything for quite some period of time. I believe part of the delay, at least, would have been attributable to a court reporter preparing the transcript of that first trial for review by the trial judge.
A year?
It was longer, Your Honor.
How much of the transcript would have to have been prepared? Just the partial testimony of one witness, right?
Well, that testimony actually had been prepared prior to the trial. The testimony of the expert was taken by video tape deposition, so we had the transcript to present to the trial court prior to that first trial.
Then what had to be prepared?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't know that there was anything additionally which neither the plaintiff nor the defense, for that matter, requested preparation of the transcript. It was the court which requested the preparation of the transcript.
Okay, well, let's get to the point then. What is this distinction made between using the possibility testimony, as your seven uses of the word possibility would suggest to us in your opening comments, you being used for the purpose of impeaching the credibility of the doctor and its inconsistency within a reasonable medical probability?
Respectfully, the law in this state is that any expert testimony, and in particular medical expert testimony, has to be to a reasonable probability, in this case reasonable medical probability. On page 856 of the appendix, in this case, the court gave an instruction, which the parties had submitted, the parties were required to submit form instructions to the court prior to trial. We'd agreed upon this.
I think we all understand that. What I'm trying to get at, what is the rationale for granting the motion for a new trial? On what I understand to be the theory that should have been allowed to ask those questions, the jury should have heard about these possibilities given an EMG, on the basis the EMG was a matter of routine, but in this case, for some reason, he didn't undergo an EMG, ostensibly because he couldn't afford it. But the doctor testified to the possibilities that might result from a review of the EMG. But what's the distinction between the jury hearing that to impeach his testimony about the reasonable medical probability of 37 years of permanency and the fact that it clearly isn't testimony that states within a reasonable medical probability the EMG would have disclosed a situation that could have been within a reasonable probability repaired by surgery? We all know that's not his testimony in terms of the basis for forming his opinion. But tell me about this distinction the trial judge seemed to make about using that testimony to impeach his credibility on his original opinion there was permanency.
Well, the trial judge in his post-trial opinion looked at two possible reasons why this possibility testimony may be admissible. One, the defense was arguing a mitigation of damage defense, a lack of mitigation of damages on behalf of Mr. O'Reilly. He didn't have the EMG, and Mr. O'Reilly testified that he couldn't afford the EMG. His insurance premiums, his insurance limits had run out on the case. The court found that for the affirmative defense of failure to mitigate damages, that the trial court properly excluded it. But then the basis of the trial court's opinion, as Your Honor articulated, is that somehow possibilities are relevant for impeachment purposes, to impeach the doctor's opinion as to the extent of permanent injury.
Well, why wouldn't that be helpful to a jury? Let's assume hypothetically a case where you have two dueling experts and they're diametrically opposed to each other in terms of their opinions on permanency or any other issue. If you get one doctor to acknowledge the possibility that the other doctor is right, why isn't that helpful to the jury to determine credibility?
Because it's contrary to Delaware law. It's contrary to the law of this case, in which the court instructed the jury in accordance with agreement.
But the court also instructed on credibility. Isn't that true?
The court instructed on credibility and every other factor. Well, gave a special instruction on credibility of expert witnesses, but also the general credibility instruction, and jurors can use all the different factors. The jury heard in the first trial that Dr. Harriet wanted Mr. O'Reilly to have an EMG.
Right, that's your argument that if there was an error, it was harmless. Because the jury heard all that, there was argument to the jury about it, and the jury at least initially found for the plaintiff, correct?
Correct, but not only on the harmless, because that's the impeaching characteristic of this supposed opinion testimony.
Well, your argument is there's no error, but if there was, it was harmless.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Let me ask you a different question. You would agree, would you not, that in a case like this where the plaintiff produces opinion testimony from an expert, the defense doesn't, the defense counsel is entitled to impeach the opinion of the expert, correct?
Yes, and there are a number of ways, absolutely.
Okay, and suppose the questions that are used for impeachment don't use the word possibility in any form. For example, suppose the questions were, you wanted, you know, the plaintiff to have an MRI. Yes. Did he have it? No. You wanted him to go through some other procedure, procedure X. Is that correct? Yes. And he didn't do it. Correct? Yes. You could do that, could you not, as long as the word possibility is not used?
Yes, and because that's not opinion testimony as to permanency or in medical opinion, and that was exactly what was done in this case.
Okay, so you're saying it's fine to question about facts, historical facts, but not anything that gets close to an opinion without using the reasonable medical probability standard.
And that goes to opinion. In fact, that was the trial court's pretrial opinion, and counsel for both sides then agreed upon and on the basis of that opinion, what should be excluded and what should not be excluded.
You made a statement that I'm not sure I understand. I think you said the jury heard this testimony about possibility, but in fact they did not.
I misspoke then, if that's what I said. The jury
because what happened was you had the videotape deposition, there was an objection to the possibility testimony, and the initial ruling in the first trial was the jury can't hear it. It's excluded, right? So the jury never heard him testify that if I wanted him to have an EMG, if he had had an EMG, the following waterfall could have occurred.
Well, it was a sua sponte decision of the court. It wasn't even on the basis of a plaintiff's objection in that case. But
the jury didn't hear it.
The jury didn't hear him talking about possibilities. The jury heard that Dr. Harriet wanted Mr. O'Reilly to have an MRI. Actually, an EMG, test.
The jury heard that, and they heard the argument based on that. Correct.
Yes, and then the defense hammered that point, and even in the first
trial. But simply that there wasn't an EMG? without knowing what would have happened if there had been one?
Well, Mr. The defense...
What is there to argue about?
The defense argued and received an instruction on failure to mitigate damages in that first trial that, in fact, Mr. it's his own fault. The doctor's telling you go get an EMG, and Mr. O'Reilly didn't do that, and therefore he could have minimized his damage.
But the jury didn't hear what would flow from having the EMG, as I understand it, or am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong. At page 9...
Well, what's the relevance of it if there's no consequence from not having an EMG?
Failure to mitigate. Failure to mitigate damage.
Well, how's the jury going to understand how it's going to mitigate if no one explains why the doctor wanted him to have an EMG and what could possibly flow from that?
Well, an argument can and was made by the defense that Mr. O'Reilly should have done everything that every doctor tells him to go ahead and do, and if he's not doing that to try to make himself better, he's not completely mitigating his damages and limiting his damage, so therefore defendant should not be responsible.
So somehow it just logically flows if he had an EMG, it would have mitigated his damages. Is that the argument?
That's essentially where the defense went in that first trial, yes.
Is that the argument for the jury?
The argument that was made to the jury, yes.
So what happened here was the videotape deposition, the judge, sua sponte, basically excluded from the jury's hearing these references to possibility, correct?
Opinion evidence from the medical expert on possibility, yes.
And then a year later, the judge changed his mind.
In response to the defense post-trial motion for new trial after seeing what the verdict was in the case.
And what I was trying to get at is, what was the basis for that? Explain to me the judge's ruling that it's allowed for impeachment purposes, but not allowed to establish lack of permanency, direct evidence of lack of permanency.
And
how's the jury going to understand that without a limiting instruction? In my review, the record indicates there was none.
There was none, and in fact, the judge expressly told the jury, in order for you to find a fact based on Dr. Harriet's testimony, that testimony must be based on reasonable medical probabilities, not just possibilities. Again, on 856 of the appendix. This was the agreed-upon instruction. This is the law.
But nevertheless, they heard the doctor's testimony about if he had had an EMG, which is normal under these circumstances, it might have resulted in the following XYZ chain of events. But they didn't have any basis to understand that other than that it's supposed to impeach his testimony?
Not the XYZ chain of events. They heard about him, that Dr. Harriet had recommended the EMG.
In the second trial?
No, at the first trial.
In the second trial, did they hear that?
They heard everything, including the chain of events. Which
and that's what you say is error on appeal.
What is the error on appeal is overturning the jury verdict in the first trial because the court's decision pre-trial, first trial, was in fact...
Court got it right the first time.
Exactly. That's
which means they got it wrong the second time in your view.
Yes.
What I was trying to confirm is,
sir,
the error is after having granted a new trial, the error was allowing the jury to hear about possibilities that might have occurred based solely on an impeachment credibility standard rather than testimony that was based upon a reasonable medical probability standard about what would have happened had there been an EMG. Is that correct?
Yes, it logically follows, pursuant to Justice Richards'
question. How could we believe that the jury properly understood the purpose that testimony was limited to without an immediate, explicit, limiting instruction?
They weren't, and again, when we talk about consequences here, and I talked about some of the possible consequences if doctors are going to be permitted to speculate upon possibilities on cross-examination, but from the plaintiff's point of view, would it have been proper in the second trial then for plaintiff's counsel to argue that, hey, there's a possibility that this man might need neck surgery, decompressive neck surgery, major neck surgery, so therefore you members of the jury, even though the doctors just said possibly, should award damages for the amount of money for the surgery, pain and suffering for the surgery, et cetera.
Is there no longer any attention paid to what used to be the practice, if not the rule, that a defendant could not rely upon a plaintiff's expert to make its case? Is that no longer the practice?
That I don't believe that is any longer the practice. I believe the defense is free to attempt to make their arguments based upon not only direct examination but the cross-examination.
But your point is here, as I understand it, that defense on the theory of being able to impeach the credibility of the plaintiff's expert actually turned the plaintiff's expert into its own on the theory of permanency by speculating about what might have happened had there been an EMG.
And thus permitting the jury to speculate based upon what is irrelevant.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, I would. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Dale and Justices. Mary Sherlock on behalf of the defendant appellee, Sean Rogers.
Do you agree with Mr. Gill that it's no longer the practice to bar the defense from using the plaintiff's expert as their own?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that there's anything that requires the defense to put on their own medical expert. And that really strikes at the heart of the essence of this appeal. The plaintiff has the burden of proof. The plaintiff has the burden of proving damages, including permanency. And the procedural posture that this entire issue, which is a very limited issue, as Your Honors know, came about, is because I had a motion in limine. First of all, in Dr. Harriet's videotape trial deposition, when my questions were asked in regard to possibility, there was no objection. I filed the motion in limine because Dr. Harriet had opined that Mr. Riley had a permanent injury, yet he had acknowledged that it was possible that his complaints, his subjective complaints, would improve depending on future treatment protocol.
This is a motion in limine, the first trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's where the judge, sua sponte, said no discussion about probability, possibility.
Correct. Judge Stokes said, well, that argument would go to weight. However, sua sponte, he struck my cross-examination in regards to the possibility.
Refresh my memory on the rules regarding depositions. If there's not an objection to the form of the question, it's waived?
That is my understanding, Your Honor. And there was no objection to the form, which I think would have been appropriate.
Let me make sure I understand your position. Now, the defense doesn't have to call its own expert, but if it did, the defense would have to support that expert medical testimony with the qualification that my opinion is based on a reasonable medical probability.
Correct, Your Honor.
But the defense can cross-examine the plaintiff's expert and establish the negative on the plaintiff's expert by a possibility not having to reach the same standard of within a reasonable medical probability. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, because the distinction is, I believe that the law in Delaware is that if it is a substantive opinion that's being elicited, whether it's from the plaintiff's medical expert or the defense medical expert, it must be stated within reasonable medical probability. And this answers your question as to the basis for Judge Stokes' decision. He stated, it's page 6 of his decision, on the morning of trial, part of Dr. Harriet's deposition testimony was stricken sua sponte. Trial evidence must be properly presented even without an objection. The excluded part was defense cross-examination of Dr. Harriet. Both questions and answers were couched in terms of possibilities rather than probabilities. At first blush, the cross-examination appeared to seek substantive opinions. Substantive opinions in this state, whether it's from plaintiff or defense, must be stated within reasonable medical probability.
However, at first glance or first blush, the question seemed to elicit or substantive opinions, but later he changed his mind and said they don't seek to elicit substantive opinions?
Correct.
Then what do they seek to elicit?
He says the proffered evidence would not support it. However, cross-examination has an impeaching quality of testing the basis of expert opinion and whether possibilities were considered. The jury understood that an EMG was desired, and the jury knew Dr. Harriet wanted more information for a definitive diagnosis. A jury was tasked with measuring the depth and credibility of the permanency opinion. But the jury was not told that the injuries may not be permanent in nature depending on future treatment protocols.
Isn't that substantive opinion testimony?
No, it's impeaching the basis for the doctor's opinion as to permanency. Without straightforward information, Dr. Harriet's opinion was not fully tested, and the jury may have given it more weight than it deserved. Upon review, this testimony should have been presented. Its exclusion was not harmless given the prominence of Dr. Harriet's opinion. Defendant was prejudiced. And I apologize to the court and to opposing counsel. There is nothing on point in regards to this particular issue. The case of...
You mean no case in point?
Yes, I'm sorry. Money versus Manvolt, which is cited by the defense, states in part, and this was 1991 by the Supreme Court of Delaware, we hold that to make a prima facie showing with respect to the cause of asbestos-related disease, a plaintiff must introduce direct, competent expert medical testimony that a defendant's asbestos product was a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries. This holding requires the plaintiff's expert medical witness to state, in terms of reasonable medical probability, that there was a causal relationship between the defendant's product and the plaintiff's physical injury.
Well, the plaintiff's expert witness doctor did testify that the plaintiff's condition, at least as of that moment, to a reasonable medical probability, was permanent injury.
Correct.
All right. You wanted to impeach that.
Correct.
But there was no dispute, was there, that the injury was permanent? Weren't you really arguing that had a different procedure been followed, then some procedure shy of doing nothing or taking therapy might have solved the problem?
Correct, because the jury was allowed to hear from Dr. Harriet that he recommended an EMG test.
Right, but the point is that didn't really impeach the opinion that this plaintiff was permanently injured.
Yes, it does, Your Honor, because permanent is permanent.
All it would have done is to make out an affirmative case, or maybe an affirmative defense, that yes, this plaintiff is permanently injured, but that wasn't necessary, had a different procedure been followed. Isn't that affirmative substantive testimony in the guise of impeachment?
The plaintiff has the burden of proving that the plaintiff's condition is permanent. Dr. Harriet did not testify within reasonable medical probability that Mr. O'Reilly had reached maximum medical improvement. He testified that he had these ongoing left elbow subjective complaints of pain that might be coming from the ulnar nerve or it might be coming from the cervical spine, and he really couldn't determine a mode of future treatment until the EMG test was completed, and that's when I said, then is it possible that his subjective complaints could improve depending on future treatment protocol? And his answer was yes. I think that is a fair impeachment of his opinion that the ongoing subjective complaints for the rest of his life.
It may be a fair impeachment. The question is what is the characteristic of the impeachment testimony that is that has to be elicited in order for that testimony to be admitted and heard by a jury?
Yes.
And isn't it correct that that testimony would in effect, even though coming in through the channel of impeachment, would be substantive medical opinion? That is, his situation now is permanent, but if he could get an MRI or some other imaging and which may lead to surgery, then it might not be permanent.
Correct. I think
that's a medical opinion.
Impeachment. The damage jury instruction in this case, which is a standard damage jury instruction, it's at B19 of plaintiff's appendix, defendant's appendix, states, quote, first, damages must be proved with reasonable probability and not left to speculation. Damages are speculative when there's only a possibility rather than a reasonable probability that an injury exists. That the jury was instructed on that, and that's what I was able to...
How does the jury understand that it's only a possibility, not a reasonable medical probability? that if an EMG were to be performed, it might, it possibly could result in a finding that's inconsistent with my opinion that without it, there's permanency. How are they going to understand that? It's one speculation built on another, isn't it? If he'd had this treatment, it might have resulted in something that would change my opinion, but he hasn't had the treatment. But who knows what the treatment, or not treatment, but the test, who knows what the EMG might have said? No one knows. The jury's being asked, in order to impeach his permanency opinion, which he gave to a reasonable medical probability, they're being asked to say that can't be entirely correct, or there's a question about it, because there's a possibility that if there were another test, there was a further possibility that that further test might have come to an inconsistent result. But there's nothing upon which to base that other than speculation. How is that impeachment and not a backdoor opinion that falls short of the threshold of reasonable medical probability?
Well, I guess it goes to the essence of what is permanent. And that, again, the plaintiff has the burden of proving. Mr. O'Reilly's complaints were subjective.
No, I understand that. And the plaintiff offered the doctor's testimony that based on what he knows now, within a reasonable medical probability, there's permanency.
Correct.
But the jury was allowed to hear under the guise of impeachment more than that, that if another test had been given, and I would recommend that there be one, but my patient can't afford it, so there isn't an EMG. But there's a possibility, if there were an EMG, a possibility that the EMG would disclose facts that could possibly lead to surgery that might move a nerve in such a way that he doesn't have pain. But it's all speculative.
Well, no, because Dr. Harriet testified in both cases that the EMG would allow him to determine where Mr. O'Reilly's subjective complaints were coming from, whether it was coming from the elbow or the neck. He couldn't even determine that.
Well, there's another way that this issue could have gotten placed before the jury, and that is in your cross-examination during the deposition, you could have established from Dr. Harriet that Dr. Harriet had recommended, an EMG?
Yes.
That the patient, the plaintiff, declined to follow that advice. And then, just take in, not going any further, and then at trial, putting on your own expert and saying, you know, this is what happened. The plaintiff declined to follow that advice. If he had followed that advice, what would be the consequence? And then your expert could have opined, presumably to a reasonable medical possibility, that had that protocol been followed, then there wouldn't be permanency. And nobody would be complaining. We wouldn't be here today, correct?
Well, in due respect, Your Honor, I think that would still be going back to speculation.
Why would it go back to speculation if your own expert, which was, and there wasn't any, could have testified to a reasonable medical probability that there would be a consequence that would be less dire than 30 years of permanency or 12 years of permanency, I forget the number.
Because then I believe it would be my medical expert speculating on what could have been and should have been and what is medical.
Your medical expert, in other words, would not be able to testify within a reasonable medical probability.
Correct.
Had there been an expert.
Correct, which really neither could Dr. Harriet, and that's what I was trying to do.
Well, you would have had to seek an order that the plaintiff undergo an EMG, which your expert could then have reviewed, but you didn't want to spend that money. And you didn't want to help make the plaintiff's case, so you didn't do it.
Correct.
That's a tactical decision.
We chose not to call
I'm not concerned about that. You're all entitled to make whatever tactical decision you want and spend money or not spend money for your defense. What I'm concerned about is how does the jury understand this nuance that even we are having difficulty understanding, the five of us, between the possibility of an EMG occurring and the possibility that it might show X, and the possibility, if it does show X, it might result in Y operative procedure, which possibly could cure his pregnancy. It would have determined whether the pain was coming from the neck or coming from the elbow, and it would determine whether it's neuropathology suggests that the nerve could simply be moved from a pressure point and the pain would go away. How does the jury understand that's not a fact because it's only used for impeachment purposes because it tends to undermine the reasonable medical probability of permanency because there was something else that could have been done that even the plaintiff's doctor wanted done but wasn't done because the plaintiff couldn't afford it, not because the plaintiff said he wouldn't do it. He just couldn't afford it, as I understand the record. Now, how does the jury understand that without a limiting instruction either just before that testimony is given or just after that testimony is given? Make me comfortable that the jury could understand this.
Okay, because I think that the limiting instruction, I think the law of Delaware is
that...
There
wasn't one, right?
Correct, because in the first case, the jury didn't even get to hear that.
Yes, in the second case, there wasn't a limiting instruction.
Correct, and the logical conclusion is that the jury determined that the plaintiff had failed to meet their burden of proving that Mr. O'Reilly's injury was permanent in nature.
Or the logical conclusion is in the second trial they were allowed to rely on a possibility, where in the first trial they were restricted to reasonable medical probability in forming their opinion about permanency.
Correct. If I may just conclude.
Can I just ask you to help me understand your argument in the context of statements that this court has made in Oxendine, a doctor's testimony that a certain thing is possible is no evidence at all. His opinion as to what is possible is no more valid than the jury's own speculation as to what is or is not possible.
Again, because the doctor's substantive opinion, whether it's coming from the plaintiff's expert or the defense expert, has to be stated within reasonable medical probability. This court, and there's no case on point that I could find that says that every question of a medical expert in cross-examination must be couched or phrased in terms of reasonable medical probability.
But that's the converse, that any question can be phrased using possibilities. Do you have a case that allows that?
Yes. The AT&T wireless case that Judge Stokes relied on, I believe, although it was a workman's comp case, in terms of the principle elicited in that case, is completely on point,
one case in the United States that says that.
Well, only one that the court was able to find, if I might just read part of it. One of the purposes of cross-examination of an expert is to suggest the existence of a hypothesis contrary to that adopted by the expert. For that reason, parties are permitted wide latitude in cross-examination. Failure to permit full and fair cross-examination of matters testified on direct is harmful error. While it is true the injury, its cause, and any manifestation must be established by competent substantial evidence within reasonable degree of medical probability of certainty, this determination is made by the fact finder when deciding whether a party has proven its case. There is no statutory requirement that every question of an expert on cross-exam must be phrased in the rigid terms sought by claimant's counsel. Such an inflexible requirement would be completely at odds.
There's no argument being made here that every question, every impeachment question, has to be couched in terms of reasonable medical probability. The argument is that when the impeachment question tries to elicit what is in substance a substantive medical opinion, then it must be couched in terms of reasonable medical probability. That's where the two of you disagree.
But, Your Honor, that's not why Judge Stokes sua sponte struck it. The record, the transcript is before the court. He said, it's my understanding that every question must be couched within reasonable medical probability.
Okay, well, he may have gotten the wrong reason to get to the right result.
Well, every question that asks for the physician expert's opinion about a medical condition, one would suspect, would have to be couched within a reasonable medical probability. But obviously not every question directed, because you are as expert as anyone I know at cross-examining experts, and you know that you can ask about the factual assumptions they make and say, did you assume that based solely on the diagnostic tools available to you there was permanency? Did you explore EMG, MRI, CAT scan, or any other diagnostic option? No, no, and no. And then you can argue to the jury, how can you be certain about this doctor's opinion within a reasonable medical probability, because he said these are routine diagnostics tests that were not available to him. That has nothing to do with couching it in terms of possibility or reasonable medical probability. What I'm having trouble with is understanding this fine distinction between it's okay to ask questions impeaching a doctor's opinion to a reasonable medical probability in terms of possibility, in order to negate probability, without calling any expert of your own or without putting forth any facts that would support the reverse conclusion. It's an seesaw imbalance here. And I'm trying to understand how a jury would grasp that distinction. The jury is actually hearing, allegedly for impeachment purposes, medical evidence that has a possibility of changing the result juxtaposed against an opinion to a reasonable medical probability. How does a jury get that, understand that, without a limiting instruction, and none was given here? That's the problem I'm having.
Well, again, because I think that I wasn't trying to elicit an opinion. I was trying to impeach the basis for his permanency.
No, I understand that, and I think what you're doing, trying to raise a question about could the jury really rely on his opinion to a reasonable medical reasonable medical probability in the absence of these other tests that he thought were important. Right. But the problem I am having with it is not only do you raise the question about would these tests have been helpful to him before he formed his opinion within a reasonable medical probability, but you speculate on what the results would have been that would have changed. And we don't know what the results, nor does the jury know what the result of an EMG might have been under these circumstances. They were allowed to speculate that the possibility would be the EMG would produce a result which would change his opinion. But he never said, to a reasonable medical probability, had I been able to review an EMG, I would find no permanency because it would have resolved outstanding issues in my mind. He never said that. He just said it was a possibility.
He said it was a possibility that the future medical treatment would reduce the subjective complaints of pain. That's the whole case, that the subjective ongoing complaints of pain are permanent for the rest of his life.
I understand, but the argument to us isn't that it's proper to mitigate damages. The argument presented to us is there was a new trial granted on the basis that it was proper impeachment testimony of the core issue, whether right. There's a reasonable medical probability of permanency.
Right, because that was the whole focus. They only had the one expert, and correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Respectfully, it is the plaintiff's position that the law is established in this area. The law was established in every jury instruction that's given in personal injury cases, and it's the law of the case. And I keep referring back to page A56, which articulates exactly what the Chief Justice indicated, that for a medical expert, in this case it's a medical expert, but it applies to every expert, really, any opinion has to be to a reasonable medical probability. And the court says not just possibilities.
But the argument we've just heard is this discussion about the EMG and what might have flowed from it isn't a roundabout way of eliciting another expert opinion based on a reasonable medical probability. It's to suggest that if something was not done that the doctor would have liked to have done before he formed his opinion that there was a reasonable medical probability of permanency, that weakens the argument to the jury that there actually was permanency. And that for impeachment purpose, it's perfectly appropriate to ask those questions, even if they're taken to the standard of a possibility rather than a reasonable medical probability. What's wrong with that?
Because that's exactly what the court instructed the jury not to do. The court instructed the jury, in order for you to find a fact based on Dr. Harriet's testimony. In other words, that the permanency is impeached.
Let me ask it a different way. What would have been improper about asking the doctor, you didn't have an EMG done, did you? No. You didn't have an MRI done, did you? No. You didn't have a CAT scan done, did you? No. You didn't have extra blood work done or whatever might be relevant. Or maybe follow up each of those. Would it have been relevant or helpful to you in forming your opinion? All of that could have been asked. Would there be a problem about that?
No, sir. No, sir, because that's the basis of his opinion. The problem is when he branches off his opinion to reasonable medical probability. But the problem is when he branches off into giving opinions to a possibility, and that is what I think has been articulated here.
Doesn't this go to the form of the question, and wasn't that objection waived at the deposition?
No, it does not go to the form of the question. This is substantive. And, in fact, the trial court dealt with that specific issue in the trial court's decision, that this is a substantive issue. The trial court has a duty, actually, to make sure that improper evidence is not submitted in front of a jury, regardless, actually, as to whether it had been waived or not. But this is not a leading question type of scenario. This is a substantive objection. And once again, I did not make that. This was a sua sponte decision of the court. I did not make this objection in a pretrial posture on behalf of the plaintiff.
The standard of review is abuse of discretion, correct?
No, Your Honor. It's
well, this is an evidentiary question. Why isn't it abuse of discretion?
Because it's a question of law. It's a question of law, and we look at Strauss v. Biggs, 525 Atlantic 2nd, 992. We're not simply weighing facts in this case. It's this court's obligation on reviewing the trial court's decision on motion for a new trial.
You're saying it was an improper application of a statutory requirement?
An improper decision of law, and Your Honor, once again...
An improper decision of law because it applied the law incorrectly.
Yes, sir.
In this case.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, exactly. And just to close up, and I really want to go back to Justice Ridgely's, as the court is doing a lot better job succinctly making my points than I am. There's no doubt the trial court got it right once and got it wrong once as far as the court's decisions on this issue. It's the plaintiff's position that the trial court obviously got it right the first time, and that is the decision.
Right the first time for the wrong reason, right?
No. We believe that he had exactly the right to, this was an opinion, a substantive opinion, as to an improper standard, which he should have excluded.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.